The devil was part of the original creation, and if you believe in God, then you must believe in the devil. But, of course, that's nothing to do with Christian religion at all. There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. And in any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more than we know what is eternity.
And you believe that light and darkness, right and left, good and evil, are two absolutely separate but equally powerful
warring powers. And the devil is only just a name for power of evil.
You referred just now to invisible influences. I'm perhaps a bit of a cynic, and I tend not to believe in these sort of things. Why do you believe in them?
Well, one invisible influence is, for example, the influence of the moon on the tides. There is good reason to suppose that all the planets have an influence on us. Hypnotism, which has been proved again and again, telepathy, which is beyond dispute now, dowsing for water, they are invisible influences.
How did you first get involved in this interest?
Only because I was gassed in the First World War, so I had to give up tennis and all other outdoor sports, so I read enormously, and I read a great deal of fiction, but I also read accounts of Egyptology and all the ancient religions and so on, and became interested in that sort of thing. So when I had written three very successful thrillers, I was just simply looking round for a new form of excitement and so on, and it suddenly struck me, well, why not write a book about the black arts, Satanism? So I wrote The Devil Rides Out, and since then, although I've written 60 books, only 8 of my books have been about the occult, but they've all been very successful.
You say that today the power of darkness in this eternal war with the power of light is threatening to come out on top. If this continues on an ever-increasing scale, the inevitable result will be a return to the brutal lawlessness, poverty, and insecurity of the Dark Ages. Do you really believe that about the modern
day? I do believe that. The violence and that sort of thing that's going on today is unbelievable, and the government are not controlling it. And that doesn't go only for this country. It's all over Europe and the United States worse than ever. And they've just got to take a line.
Well, give me an example of how the power of darkness, as you call it, is operating in this town, in this country today.
Well, there are said to be over 300 covens in this country. Covens, that is 13 people making up a coven of witches. And they're increasing every day, I suppose, because the two world wars have made great insecurity with young people, and they're looking for something, you must have something to cling on to, and they are tempted by these evil people, not necessarily people who have real power, but evil people, to come to these parties, who promise you want to marry the boss, all right, you come along on Tuesday, you have a little fun and that sort of thing, and so on. And that is where an immense amount of the dope pushing, that sort of thing, goes on, because witches and their servants have always used drugs.
Do you know, have you met modern witches?
When I first wrote my first book on black magic, before I wrote it, I took trouble to get an introduction to Aleister Crowley, to Rollo Ahmed, to Harry Price, Montague Summers, all of whom were top boys in that line, and I used to have them to lunch and dinner and talk to them. I had many conversations, but I've never dabbled in it myself, because I am absolutely certain no good can come of it, and you'll probably get so interested in this thing that you neglect your wife, you neglect your job, and there it is, if you're weak-minded, you can end up in a loony bin.
I wonder if you don't perhaps sometimes feel a sense of responsibility yourself for the state of affairs, because there is no doubt your books sell in absolutely fabulous numbers. Your
they
books
do.
About black magic. Are you catering for the very thing that you are against?
I can't believe that, because in every book I write, I always give a warning that this thing is evil and no good can ever come to anybody who dabbles in it.
You haven't quite answered my question. Aren't you feeding the curiosity that is creating this evil?
No, I don't. I feel that by warning people, so many people are drawn into this thing, and I feel that I, at least, am in warning them. It's not a good thing to do.
Do you think they might ever strike at you?
No, I have complete confidence in my own protection, because they can only strike at people who are afraid and who believe that they can be harmed. And I don't. I don't say that I'm particularly good person, but I believe that I'm on the right side, and I believe the powers of light will protect me from anything that anybody could ever attempt about me.
But you're fearful the powers of darkness may take us over.
I think that civilization is disintegrating. Unless somebody takes a pull, things are getting worse and worse every year.
Are you a Londoner, Mr. Wheatley?
I was born in London.
Mm-hmm.
South of the Thames.
According to my reference books, you were born just before the turn of the century.
1897, uh-huh. January the 8th.
Have you any particular memories of London as a child in those days?
Not very early memories, but fairly early. I mean, when I was kind of 8 and 10, that sort of thing.
Mm.
And one remembers it well, the horses, the hansom cabs and horse omnibuses, chaps running after them with shovel and broom,
yeah,
and all that sort of thing.
It was rather fun travelling on a horse bus as a child.
Oh, yes, particularly for a small boy. Sitting next to the driver was a great privilege.
Did you read much?
Oh, yes, from a very early age. And Dumas was my first love.
Ah.
And I read all of Dumas, and it was one of the things that kind of set me on the path of writing.
That was really a turning point, because he was the great adventure
writer.
He
was the greatest historical novelist we've ever had, I think.
Yes. Had you any ambitions to be a writer as a boy?
Well, I used to tell stories in my dormitory at school, after lights out. Highwaymen and pirates and that sort of thing, you know, continued in our necks night after night. Used to make it up as I went along. And I had no idea that I was going to be a writer. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. Your family were Mayfair wine merchants, I think.
Yes, that's right. My grandfather started a business next to a chapel in South Audley Street.
Mm.
And then my father took it on, and I joined the business early in 1914. And August 14, I was going to France.
Mm.
And then, of course, the war broke. So I had my year in France later on, but it wasn't learning to make wine. I had a lot of friends in Westminster Dragoons, so I tried to get in there as a private, and they wouldn't have me because I couldn't ride. And I tried various things, and eventually, in September 14, I was given a commission in the 1st City of London Royal Field Artillery.
Mm.
And I remained there until I was gassed later on at Passchendaele, and invalided out in January 1919. I had 4.5 years of it.
And what about after the war? Did you become a wine merchant?
Well, I went straight back into the family business, of course.
Mm.
And my father died in 1926, and I took it over.
Yes. Now we come to when you actually turned to writing. What made you do this?
Well, the business was very undercapitalized, and I had it after my father's death, and I doubled the size of the business, the turnover, but I hadn't got the capital to support it. And then the great slump came along, and so I got into very serious money difficulties, and at that time was another very fine firm who had to move out of their old premises in Park Lane, and it was very convenient for them to move to South Audley Street into me. And so I became one of the 8 directors, and previously that, of course, I had been my own master. And afterwards, my income went down, but I had no responsibilities. I hadn't got to buy the wine, I hadn't got to get out catalogues or advertising, only just look after my personal customers. So I thought, well, I'll try and make a little bit of extra money, and I had lots of leisure, so I wrote The Forbidden Territory.
Now, was this a sort of a throwback to the sort of stories you used to say, you used to tell when you were at
Well, I would think it was. You see, that first story of The Forbidden Territory, it had 4 principal characters, the Duke de Richelieu, Simon Arran, Rex Van Ryn, and Richard Eaton, and they were really modelled on the Musketeers.
Yes.
Yeah. And today, I mean, they're known as those modern Musketeers.
Yes.
You see, so that was the influence of Dumas at the very beginning.
Quite. Very good influence, too. Very profitable one.
Very profitable, I'm happy to
say. How old were you when your first novel was published?
I was 36.
Hmm. You weren't afraid that you'd started a bit late in life?
Oh, no, I think it's a very good thing indeed to start late, because I think that's the misfortune of a great number of potentially fine writers, that they start far too young. They haven't the experience, they haven't travelled, they haven't the background, they haven't been married and had children. Hmm. Upsets of all sorts, you see. Whereas if you don't start until you're 35, well, you have had a considerable experience of life. I'd travelled quite a lot by then and so on. I think you're on much firmer ground.
Let's jump ahead. In the last war, you were invited to serve on the joint planning staff of the War Cabinet. You were the only civilian ever to receive such an invitation. How did this come about?
When the war broke, I immediately supposed that my proper place was the Ministry of Information. And I volunteered to serve for the duration of the war, free graces for nothing. I never even received a reply. I wrote him 3 times. And my friend said, well, Dennis, your job is to continue writing as an entertainer, because more people than ever will want to read your books in during a blackout and air raid wars and so on. And so I did, until just before the Blitz on France. And then my wife was already in MI5, and she was driving an officer who'd been told that, to look for ideas to resist invasion. And he said, well, we've done everything we can think of. So she said, well, why don't you ask my husband? He's dying to do something useful. And so I was asked, and I wrote a paper very quickly. It was a state of emergency in those days, and 5,000 words on resistance to invasion. And I gave him this paper, and he said, well, I think it's a good paper. When we'll get action, I don't know. So I said, do you mind if I take it also to other friends? And I took one to a friend of the Admiralty, one to the War Office, and one to the Air Ministry. And to cut a long story short, this paper went to Joint Planning Staff. And then Sir Leigh Gregg asked me out to lunch, and they asked me to write another paper upon how the Germans could invade and conquer Britain. Yeah. And I wrote 20,000 words on the subject. That went to the Chiefs of Staff. And then, after that, I wrote no less than 500,000 words in about 20 papers, how to keep Turkey out of the war, home of village defence, God knows what, all sorts of things they asked me. And, of course, a lot of the ideas were nonsense. But they kept on saying, I had a mind like a Nazi, whereas they had been taught to fight war like cricket. And so my papers were very useful. And yeah. Then, when the time came, they said, well, you must have you in.
Yeah.
And so Pilot Officer Wheatley, the lowest form of commissioned life, went into a Joint Planning Staff and stayed there for 3 years as one of Churchill's staff.
Are you able to talk about any of your suggestions, for instance, for a resisting invasion?
Oh, yes, those are non-secret, because I wrote them myself. In fact, I was persuaded to publish a book on them.
Mm. What are some?
Called Stranger Than Fiction. One, I think, was to commandeer all the rowing boats and fill them up with explosives, and put them in all... You divide England up into places which are very difficult, like the cliff areas and the bay and estuary areas, and those are the things that trouble you. And I mean, if you had 50 motorboats and all those with detonators, if the Germans came inshore, you could blow them up on the way. That was only one small thing. Yeah. But all sorts of things. Another thing was to commandeer all the barbed wire all over England and have an invasion weekend and get men, women and children everywhere to erect all this barbed wire on the beaches. Yeah. I said that every engineer in the country from 16 to 60 should be conscripted and put on all this work of digging trenches and so on, and felling trees across roads. All trees should be marked, so those to be cut, and so on. All dozens and dozens of ideas that were put up. And of course, many of them adopted. For instance, taking all the names of the railway stations off. And signposts, yes, they did that because of me. Because
it was your fault, was it?
One of the things, if the parachutes came down, it was very confusing. They didn't know where they were.
Yeah.
You see, and so you had to destroy all identification, awful bore of people. Mm.
But now, let's get back to when you became a Nazi, or they asked you to become a Nazi,
yes, yes.
And to become a Nazi mind for the invasion of Britain,
yes.
And you prophesied what they would do.
Yes.
Now, what about your forecast? Did they ever prove right?
I had the great fortune to prove right, and the War Office proved wrong. The War Office official summary was that they would land on the east coast in the estuary of the Thames. I said, to do this job, they've got to put over every man they can with every boat they can. 5-day job. And therefore, they must go over the shortest route. It must be Dover Calais. And when we got the Sea Lion operation from Berlin after the war, I proved right. Purely by luck, of course. Although, well, I was not altogether luck, because it's logical they should come the shortest way, because they must get every man they could over as quickly as they could.
Now, after it was all over, you went back to writing your bestsellers. How many books have you achieved up to now?
53.
Mm-hmm. And how many do you write a year?
Only one a year now. I wrote two a year before the war. But they are rather long books. I mean, some of them are, one of my historical ones is 250,000 words. Look, the average is about 180,000, which is nearly the length of three normal murder stories.
Mm, and how long does it take you to write one?
Well, about 7 months.
Mm-hmm. Do you, like most authors I've talked to, do you work regular office hours?
Yes, more or less. I come down to my desk 9:30 in the morning, do my correspondence, work till lunchtime. And then after lunch, it's a nice day, I go out in the garden and walk around. If it's not, I work for another hour. And then I have a nap on my sofa, and my secretary comes and calls me at 4:00 for a cup of tea. And then I work until dinner time, and after dinner until perhaps 10, 11 at night.
Now, I do
that 6 days a week.
Do you type it straight down?
No. I write with a pencil and rubber. I found it's far the best way of doing a long run.
How do you get most of your facts and your extraordinary backgrounds? So would you get it from books, your imagination, or have you always travelled a lot like...
Well, the plots are imagination, but of course all the background does come from books. I am very fortunate. I've collected books all my life, from the time I was a small boy, and I've got over 4,000 books in my house. So I don't have to go to museums or anything like that very much for research. And then I get all these notes made up of the background. So I consider it absolutely essential that the historical books, particularly, one should be have accurate backgrounds because of the young people who read them. You mustn't mislead the reader.
You've never stuck to one particular hero character like Ian Fleming's James Bond, have you?
Now,
no. I can recall Gregory Sallust.
Yes.
That's the right way to pronounce it.
That's right.
And then the secret agent of the Napoleonic Wars, Roger Brooke.
Roger Brooke.
What made you create him?
Well, the story of that was that one day, when I was in the War Cabinet offices, I used to have little lunch parties about every 10 days for people that I was working with, my colleagues, and some of them were bigger boys. And one day I had at lunch Air Chief Marshal Sir Charles Medhurst, who was Vice Chief of Air Staff at that time. And he said to me, "Dennis, what is your next first book going to be after the war?" And so I said, "Well, I honestly don't know, sir, because I dare not write another spy story, because otherwise you'll have me in the Tower of London, because I'm so stuffed full of secrets." And so he said, "Well, don't have to worry about that. All you have to do is transpose your story 150 years back, and you can say anything you like, and we shan't be able to touch you." And it was that that started the Roger Brooke series.
Yeah.
But, of course, the whole war is so completely different, one hasn't used a single thing that one learnt in the Second World War with Roger Brooke.
And when you're not working on a book, what do you do for relaxation?
Well, for one thing, I have I'm an amateur builder, and I have laid 60,000 bricks in my garden, wavy walls and all that sort of thing. And that's one of the things. I collect stamps in a small way.
Yeah.
I collect China figures of Napoleonic soldiers. Oh, I've got 101 things that I do. I'm never, I won't say idle, but I always have to be doing something or other.